I have a sense that well-meaning people with a responsibility of managing their businesses are reaching out for the small, insignificant things, a bit of demand-side management, programs, a little bit of rooftop solar, because they can control them, rather than facing a fundamental reality in the utility business that the largest, most capital-intensive business on the face of the earth is driven by almost entirely exogenous factors of weather, commodity fuel prices, and the general state of the economy.
Will knowing the value of solar energy be a boon for local solar development or uncover hidden subsidies? This week, I'm joined by Carl Rabago, called by some the granddaddy of the value of solar, to talk about this robust and transparent calculation of solar power's actual worth. Carl has been living and breathing the value of solar since his time at the municipal utility serving Austin, Texas, and he joins me to discuss the impact of Minnesota's new value of solar methodology, what it means for utilities, ratepayers, and everyone else. I'm John Farrell, and this is Local Energy Rules, a podcast sharing powerful stories of successful local renewable energy and exposing the policy and practical barriers to its expansion. Carl, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on and to talk about one of my favorite topics.
Excellent. You know, I want to start folks off by asking you, you know, what does the value of solar do differently than net metering, which is this bedrock policy that we've been using for, you know, almost 30 years?
I was facing the administrative challenge of managing a rebate budget in a extremely dynamic market, which is a very hard thing to do because you just never know when to set the price and what's going to happen. And you get these feast and famine effects. And like I said, you get this concern about free riders and free drivers and all those things. It's very hard to be economically efficient in that kind of market. So we started asking ourselves whether or not there was a simple alternative to net metering that might help address those problems. I will also tell you that even with about 5 megawatts of solar on the 1,000 systems, even though we could not truly see any real impact to our network costs, you know, the cost of the distribution network, and solar customers were not even at that level having any real impact on revenues necessary to maintain the system. We could imagine a day in which there was so much solar that we were concerned about recovering enough money to maintain the network from customers who generate all or substantially all of their electrical needs. So we had that in the back of our minds, and my view was that if we're going to make an adjustment around that, we ought to do it sooner rather than later. So what happened was that Austin, which has been had been making this amazing sort of commitment to energy efficiency, which were also programs that I had the honor to run, had actually managed to avoid a base rate case for over 17 years. It just had been unnecessary, and it was a golden moment for me to comprehensively address the solar customers. So what happened was I looked on the shelf and saw this value of solar calculation that we had been updating every year, the previous 5 or 6 years from the study that Tom Hoff had done. I saw that over time, the study bore a great relationship with reality. As gas prices went up, the value of solar went up because it was avoiding more gas prices. As gas prices went down, the value of solar went down. So that was nice. It was consonant with reality. And I started tearing the problem apart by asking, what would I do if we had never had net metering before, if we were writing on a blank slate? And what we came to the conclusion was that there were a couple things we wanted to fix. First of all, traditional net metering actually creates a kind of a perverse incentive to use more electricity, especially as if you're in Austin, where at the time, net metering, the excess production only got a couple of cents per kilowatt hour. So if you're offsetting consumption, you get full retail. Let's say it was 10 cents a kilowatt hour. But if it's excess production, you only get a couple cents per kilowatt hour. Well, that actually encourages customers to move their load to run their dishwasher when the sun is shining, which is the exact opposite of what we wanted. And we had some we actually commissioned a study by a researcher at the University of Texas that showed that what we sensed was true was actually true. Customers were doing that because they're pretty smart and they figured out how to maximize the value from their solar system. So we wanted to correct that. We had this issue that I already talked about, which is sort of a regulatory lag effect, that the value that customers receive from their solar systems is pegged to the retail rates that are set in rate cases. We don't know when those come, and I've never seen a rate case that actually tried to, that ever anybody actually sat down and said, now, you know, when we set this rate, let's make sure we keep in mind that this is what solar customers are going to get under net metering. You know, that conversation doesn't happen. So we had a mechanism for setting rates that wasn't tied to what the solar was doing, to the value of that solar. And then finally, net metering had been under attack in Texas. In 2008, the commission and the Public Utility Commission had basically wiped it out for all the parts of the state that they had jurisdiction over. Austin Energy and one or two other municipal utilities are the only ones left with net metering. So we had a little bit of concern that if we had a net metering program and it got in front of the Public Utility Commission on an appeal of our rates, they might mess with it. And of course, this was being pushed by, you know, people who said that net metering doesn't deserve any more than avoided cost under PURPA and things like that. So I had a lot of good reasons to look at it. And the moment of inspiration was to say, hey, we have this study that says solar is worth this. It's like a fully loaded avoided cost plus retail benefit. Why don't we just credit our customers at this level? And you know, the first thing that comes to mind is, well, wait, the value of solar is more than retail. And it is, because it performs all the functions of a generic kilowatt hour delivered to the meter, but it comes with fuel price volatility insurance. It's, you know, a guaranteed fuel price. It comes with insurance against climate change regulations. It comes with insurance against drought, a really big issue in Texas. And so it's actually premium to retail. So it made sense. The value of solar is worth more than retail. And that was kind of shocked us and said, but what if we paid credited customers exactly what their solar is worth? Well, two things opened up. First of all, it meant that we came to the realization that solar customers know their solar electricity is worth a lot. That's why they demand additional rebates in many cases in order to put it on. Because they don't want to just be suckers who are giving high value electricity to the utility for just retail value and net metering. Or even worse, if it's excess production, for just a few cents on the, you know, a few cents per kilowatt hour. So I took a leap of faith that if I was willing to compensate my solar customers fairly for the production they were generating, and I considered it like a resource, sort of like a power plant that they built, that they built and that we didn't have to, I might also be able to engage them in a conversation about them paying their fair share of the network costs that I would someday have a concern about. And in the end, that was the structure we came up with. We changed from net metering to net billing. The fundamental premise was two simple changes. We compensate the customers for the full value of that valuable electricity they're making on their rooftops, they're operating and insuring and maintaining for us and for the benefit of all of us. And we give them that value of solar rate, but they'd also be willing to be charged for the full level of their gross consumption, because I was willing to stand by any moment that solar system failed. And the remarkable thing about actually approaching our customers on a symmetrical basis, where I was fair to them and asked them to be fair to me, was that it was a deal they were willing to accept. It was better for solar. They had dropped the rebates by over a third since that time in Austin. The sales and installations of solar systems have more than doubled since I left, and the utility is fully recovering its cost of maintaining and administering the network. So it was both the analysis and freeing our minds to have a new idea about the relationship we could have with our customer generators.
One interesting thing that I have thought about with regard to the change from this net metering to net billing is that while there is a difference in the amount that the utility is paying, you know, in the sense that on the one hand, the net metering, they're getting the retail rate, based on their avoided consumption. And in this with Valley of Solar getting paid for their energy production directly, you know, the customer's total energy bill is probably not going to vary a whole lot, in the sense that the retail rate and the value of solar are still somewhat close to one another, at least in some places. You know, does that still present a problem for the utility then, in the sense that the customer is, you know, they're paying their full cost, yes, but their ultimate bill is still going to be reduced by the energy they produce from solar? How does that still work out?
And what's lurking behind this is the legitimate and traditional question of, what does it cost to serve a solar customer? Right? I mean, we cost of service rates from utilities are supposed to be based on a study of the cost of serving customers. Now, I've done only a couple hundred rate cases in my life in various capacities. I'll tell you my intuition, because I've actually never seen a utility cost of service study for a solar customer. That's kind of remarkable, by the way. All this debate we're having, I have never seen a published utility cost of service study that shows how the cost to serve a customer with solar differs from the cost to serve an identical customer without solar. So that's a kind of a fascinating thing. But I'll tell you, my very informed judgment is it's probably not going to be much different. So then the only real question is predicting and gauging the level of customer subscription, if you will, to solar between rate cases. And we have mechanisms for this. You know, the biggest, most notorious one is that natural gas prices vary so rapidly and so extremely that we've had to put in place fuel adjustment charges. And utilities are allowed to change fuel and pass it through to customers every year, and even change it more often if they need to. If solar revenue impacts got that severe, we could do the same thing. But I'll tell you, at least in the mainland USA and at least outside of California, no utility has had their financial integrity threatened by the amount of solar that their customers are installing. We could get to that point, and we should have studies to back up our decisions about what we do about that when we do. Does that answer your question?
It certainly does. I want to change tacks a little bit here. So in Minnesota, you know, now that we have this sense of what the value of solar is, you know, almost everyone that, you know, is in the solar energy sphere in Minnesota, the industry, the advocates, environmentalists, what have you, are pleased with the policy that we came up with the policy that was adopted. It was, you know, a value of solar calculation, but then offered on a long-term contract. What's fascinating is that we have some prominent folks from outside the state, namely the largest solar leasing companies in the country, that have really staked out a position in opposition for a host of reasons, but I think most prominently arguing that the value of solar gives utilities too much control, or that it impinges on a customer's, quote, right to self-generation. Do you think their arguments have any merit?
Well, yes, these are smart people who are doing a lot of good by installing a lot of solar in a lot of places, and I always listen to them very carefully. But I think I'd probably find some sort of slightly different things. They've also raised a tax issue, for example. So let's talk about this. First of all, the control to the utility. Utility regulation and rates is a contact sport. It would be naive to think that any new policy or any old policy is going to continue operating exactly the way you've always wanted it to, in the face of the fact that utilities are constantly with their regulators. They're regularly proposing rate cases, avoided cost proceedings, integrated resource plans, and they owe a duty to their shareholders to try to maximize profit. So those of us who have been in the utility industry on the regulatory side, I've been doing it for about 25 years, know that if you care about your policy, you've got to be there defending your policy, and hopefully you can improve your policy. So we know that 23 states there have been launched attacks against net metering. Net metering ain't safe either. So yes, it's a full-time, it's a contact sport. You know, you got to put on your pads, you know, and your helmet, and get in there and engage with the regulators. with the best ideas and the best evidence you can, because the utilities are, they're actually collecting money from ratepayers to do it themselves.
I mean, in other words, that, you know, the politics are the politics, regardless of which policy it is you're using to support solar generation, and you're going to have to defend it either way. Now, what about this, this sort of right to self-generation, this notion that net metering, because of the way that it does the, you know, net metering as opposed to net billing, you know, these are both accounting measures, not actually reflective of where the electrons go. You know, what is there to this notion of the right to self-generation with net metering, and how, you know, how does value of solar play a role in that?
It's a critical insight. First of all, I'm not sure there's a right to self-generation. I don't know that. I mean, I like the idea that we should be able to do what we want to, but I actually think this concept I've heard of, this right to self-generation, probably is too narrow. It gives up too much. It might serve one particular interest, like the sort of the solar rooftop interest, but it actually, I think it sells short the role we have as customers. So I actually think there's a bigger right inherent in the fact that we're required to take our electric service from a regulated monopoly when we want it, is that we only have to pay for what we take. And I think that right, that sort of right of self-determination, preserves us from getting charged for putting in energy efficient appliances just because we're not buying as much, or our right to be charged only when we use our electricity, so we don't have to pay, for example, you know, $100 a month if we take a month off and go on vacation, if we have the luxury of taking a month off for vacation. So tariff service has always been only pay for what you take. And I think there's a much stronger legal argument for that right of self-determining how much you use the services that the utility offers. That also benefits solar as well.
Now, Carl, I want to explore that a little further, because before we started recording this conversation, we had an interesting conversation about fixed charges. And what it sounds to me like you're saying is we should really not have a lot of fixed charges on the electricity system, even though there are fixed costs. And you gave a great example about a coffee shop. I'd love you to share that example and then tell me whether or not you think that applies to what we're talking about right now.
Here's one of the odd things coming around in the utility industry in general, and it is definitely related to solar. A lot of utility people and their consultants in particular, their rate case consultants, have been telling them, hey, an increasing fraction of your costs are associated with fixed costs. Now, of course, everybody who's, you know, taken economics 101 knows there's no such thing as a fixed cost in the long run. All costs are variable. But what they mean is, you know, recovery of the cost for your fixed assets, your long-lived poles and wires and things like that, and especially your big power plants. And so generally speaking, aside from solar, has been this conversation, and by the way, if you've ever done rate making, you know you can move the numbers any way you want to, but let's assume that there's an empirical objective truth that more costs faced by the utility are fixed, meaning that customers' rate of growth in consumption of electricity is not growing at the old galloping 4% per year, 6% per year growth rate, but rather they are keeping their consumption rates pretty flat because of, even if they are using more electricity, they're using it more efficiently. So these consultants say, well, your costs are increasingly fixed. Therefore, without any additional discussion, your rates must have an increasing fixed component. Now, let's just pause right there and say that's silly. There is nothing in Econ 101 that says the way you collect your costs, the way you collect your revenues has to be parallel to the way you incur your costs. And a lot of these consultants and stuff are saying this as if this was, you know, on a stone tablet. How you impose costs, how you incur costs must be reflected in your pricing. If that were the case, we'd all have to pay a $10 cover charge every time we walked into a coffee shop, because coffee shops are a high fixed cost business. Those coffee machines are not cheap. I guarantee you that race, that space, those chairs, those cups are all fixed costs. But nobody would run a coffee business on $10 every time you walked into the store. They've figured out that the best way to run that business is to run variable charges per cup of coffee. And they can still be profitable, as the Starbucks people have shown us. Now, carry this over to the utility business. One of the reasons that a whole lot of sort of utility people have been attacking solar is that they argue that an increasing share of their costs are fixed, and therefore they are not recovering them when customers with solar reduce the volume of their consumption. And they're saying, because we loaded some of our fixed costs into the volumetric charge. Well, there's two answers to that. First of all, if that's the case, and there's a good policy reason for higher fixed costs, then make your case. It's not because of solar that you should do it, and it's not because that's how you incur your costs. More importantly, what we should be asking would these rates be non-discriminatory? Would they accomplish other social objectives as well as economic efficiency objectives? But it has nothing to do per se with how you incurred your costs. Second of all, if solar customers are, by the nature of the fact that these fixed costs are loaded into the volumetric rates, if these solar customers are somehow not paying their fair share, then yes, we do need to have a determination about whether the volumetric rates that we've otherwise chosen to have for residential customers need to be adjusted with a higher fixed cost value, or whether a cost of service study, if and only if an actual cost of service study shows me that a solar customer imposes higher fixed costs. So what's interesting about this is there's fascinating sort of several pieces going on at the same place. I'll tell you another really quick story. Give you a pause here in case you want to ultimately edit it out. But I've been sort of going around, do a lot of speaking on this stuff, and one of the things I tell people is that I can imagine that in boardrooms across the country, utility boardrooms, the CFO is making a presentation that basically says, and so for the following reasons, members of the board, our earnings will not meet our expectations. And if you read some of the earnings reports from a lot of the utilities, that in fact seems to be the conversation that has probably been going on. Well, this, of course, jolts the board into awakeness. And the chairman says, well, what the heck is this about? What do you mean we're not meeting expectations? And they're board members. They have a job of making sure that the company remains profitable and the shareholders get their dividends. So the chairman says, well, what's causing this? And the CEO steps up and says, well, let me tell you. First thing, biggest thing, is these natural gas prices. They're relatively low and they're staying low. And so we're not getting the margin on our generation that we expected. And the chair says, well, what can we do about that? And the CEO says, well, you know, gas is a internationally traded commodity. We don't have much control over the price of gas. Okay, well, what else is causing the problem? Well, what else is causing the problem is that customer demand has slowed down. Appliances have gotten more efficient. Homes have gotten more efficient. The economy has slowed down. We're probably never going to see those great boom days of year-over-year growth in electricity consumption. And the chairman says, well, what can we do about that? And the CEO says, well, you know, we spend a little money on economic development and we give discounts to big industrial loads to keep them operating and use more electricity. But to be honest with you, we don't have much control over the economy. And the chairman says, well, what else is causing the problem? And the CEO says, well, that actually, if you account for natural gas and commodity fuel prices, if you account for the general state of the economy and the weather, that accounts for about 98 to 99% of our costs and our revenues. And the chairman says, well, what else is left? Well, what's left is a little bit of demand side management programs, a little bit of rooftop solar. Well, what can we do about that? And the CEO says, well, now that we can do something about. So, you know, I have a sense that well-meaning people with a responsibility of managing their businesses are reaching out for the small, insignificant things, but because they can control them, rather than facing a fundamental reality in the utility business that the largest, most capital-intensive business on the face of the earth is driven by almost entirely exogenous factors of weather, commodity fuel prices, and the general state of the economy. And we ought to have a better way to do business. And those are some of the ideas we tried to capture in this relationship I tried to recast with my customers regarding solar on their rooftop.
This, I think, leads perfectly into the question I wanted to ask you about what's happening in Minnesota, which is, you know, we had this robust stakeholder process. You were participating as one of, I think, the several excellent folks giving people context about how we create a formula for this value of solar. And now the utilities that were part of that process have now joined together in a motion before the Public Utilities Commission to, I guess they called, reconsider this value of solar. They didn't like how it turned out. You know, what do they have to fear from the value of solar policy? Is it really just come down to it's something that they can get their hands around when it comes to dealing with the issues in their business model?
If you know the system and you know how to make money in the system, there is a strong incentive to keep the system running the way you know how to work it. Utilities are no different from anyone else that of any other economic incumbent, that they are strongly motivated to do that. In fact, they are driven by shareholder expectations, you know, to just keep on making money the same old way as predictably as possible. I think that having talked to people in the utility industry, there should be voices that are also scoring this as regulatory opportunity. They have a chance to substantially improve their relationship with their customers and their regulators, to stop being on the wrong side of an extremely popular technology, to directly address, it was written into the law, directly address the revenue shortfall issues associated with rooftop solar, to lay a pattern for them to likewise embrace distributed storage and distributed savings and energy efficiency and demand response and security and smart grid opportunities. So if they're doing their homework right internally, they're also looking at this as a huge opportunity to basically protect the financial health of the utility for the benefit of the community and their shareholders.
You brought up something I think it's really important in that story about the utility boardroom and the fact that the business model isn't as profitable as it was, that, you know, really you've got the old Watergate saying, follow the money, in terms of figuring out why the decisions are being made the way they are. So really, you know, utilities filing this motion to reconsider, a big piece of that motion was to say, this price is too high, essentially.
Right.
And we want a different price. And ultimately, even if they agree with you that there is, in fact, regulatory opportunity in the value of solar, of course they're going to go out and file a motion to reconsider, because if they can drive that price down even by a half a cent, it's going to mean a better return for their shareholders.
Side story here about accountants that I want to make sure I tell. One of the big problems that utilities have with net metering is that the only thing that shows up under traditional net metering is the net forward progress of the bill. So if they thought, for example, that you're going to use 100 kilowatt hours this month, and that's what they baked into their rate case, and then you put solar on your roof and it turns out you only lose 20, well, they say, oh my God, we lost 80 kilowatt hours of sales and now we're in a debt spiral. But the truth is that that customer still used actually 100 kilowatt hours of electricity. They just offset their consumption by 80 that they made themselves. And if when you go to like the net billing structure, what it does is it reveals the amount of consumption so that then the utility can put that on their books. And in another place in their books, they put down a credit that they paid for the solar. And if that credit ends up being higher, say a 1 kilowatt hour generation versus 1 kilowatt hour of consumption, then the delta is what they also collect over at a sort of a fuel factor. So the utility stays whole, but we get better and more efficient price signals and a more rational system that allows sort of economic efficiency to help guide the decisions rather than the vagaries of incentives and the politics associated with that, or with the vagaries of rate cases that don't even consider solar when they set rates.
Is there a difference between how value of solar and net metering are likely to impact our ability to continue what has been rapid growth in distributed solar energy and customer-owned solar? Are there implications for whether or not we're going to continue to be able to see a lot of people becoming energy producers instead of just consumers based on the kind of policy that we pick?
The net billing construct that we came up with, Austin, virtually eliminates any argument of cross-subsidy. it makes explicit that the utility gets to charge for the maintaining the network services at the level of consumption that the customer is doing. It also sort of makes sure that the customer is treated fairly by getting fully compensated for the valuable resource they provide. So that ends the debate about cross subsidy, and that's worth a lot. And unfortunately, net metering sort of comes with that debate because we've just, on an ad hoc basis, decided that retail shall be equal to the, or shall be set as the value. Now, one of the real good things about value of solar analysis, and I'm excited to see, for example, the Alliance for Solar Choice that represents a lot of the lease companies, has filed in the North Carolina voter cost proceeding that they support value of solar analysis because it really shows us that net metering, if anything, is inadequate compensation for this great resource. So in that regard, I think we all agree that we need to value resources properly if we're going to economically decide the efficient level of the resource we're going to use. That's really good. Second of all, we should recognize that systems are dynamic. So as, let's say the ideal electric utility system is one that runs entirely on solar, plus whatever is necessary to make the solar work 24/7. Well, as the system gets more solar, more solarized, if you will, and less riddled with coal pollution and natural gas fuel price risk and, you know, nuclear decommissioning costs and things like that, then one would expect that the incremental value that solar brings goes down, right? I mean, a system that's already 50% solar, you're adding another unit of solar is not worth as much as when you add it today. And that's just a simple economic fact, because it, your incremental unit of solar when the world is 50% of solar is not much different than we're already doing. The price should already be reflected, at least to the 50% level, in the ordinary cost of doing business. So one of the things I like about sort of doing this value is that we don't end up with these sort of hangover issues. One of the reasons, besides, of course, the obvious tax reason, that I so carefully constructed the Austin tariff and, in addition, advocated for the Minnesota structure to not be a feed-in tariff and to therefore not create the taxable income issue, was also because I was in a municipal utility. And I knew that if you set a price and you set it a very high price and you run it out there for several years, especially when the technology falls in price, somebody's going to later on and say, why are we overpaying for this stuff? It's sort of like the inverse of a syntax, right? You know, the idea of a tax on cigarettes is that as customers stop smoking, we have less need for the money to run, healthcare. And the nice thing about sort of the value of solar number is that it says that if we move our electric system towards being more solarized, then the incremental difference that we need to pay customers to go solar should also go down. And then finally, I'll tell you, whatever we do, it should be based on the data, right? You know, sort of, I think Amory Lovins likes to say, you know, in God we trust, all others bring data. That's how we should run. You know, that's how we should run this fundamentally essential service and that provides us all with the electricity we need in our society.
Carl, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the opportunity.
That was John Farrell, ILSR's Director of Democratic Energy, speaking with Carl Ravago, soon to be Executive Director of the Pace Energy and Climate Center at the Pace Law School in White Plains, New York. We spoke via Skype in May 2014. You can learn more about Minnesota's value of solar from ILSR's recent report and from our extensive coverage of the stakeholder process in Minnesota on our website, ilsr.org, where you'll also find 21 other episodes of our Local Energy Rules podcast. Until next time, keep your energy local, and thanks for listening.